I'm on a reporting trip right now, so I'm away from my home studio where the rest of this episode was recorded. The episode deals a lot with Ghislaine and the crime she's accused of. But before we get into all that, just to be clear, Ghislaine has been indicted on 6 federal crimes, including enticement of minors, sex trafficking, and perjury. But she has not been convicted. She denies all charges against her and maintains her innocence. Anyway, here's the episode.
Emily, could you introduce yourself for us?
Sure. My name is Emily Saul. I am a reporter with 3 Uncanny 4. We make podcasts. Most recently, I worked with the lovely Tara Palmieri on Broken Seeking Justice, our series about the survivors of Jeffrey Epstein.
And before that, tell them about how you started in this business of digging through the muck.
I was born knee deep in muck. Tara and I at different times worked at the New York Post.
How was Ghislaine Maxwell influenced by her father? That's the question that led me into the fascinating and frightening world of Robert Maxwell. Wrapping up this series, I wanted to return to that question and take stock of Ghislaine and Robert's incredible and horrifying story. Emily and I worked together for a long time on Broken, so after spending so long learning about both Ghislaine and Robert's lives, I want to go back and debrief with her and see if we'd come up with some concrete answers. Talking to Emily really gave me some clarity, and I hope it'll do the same for you. So, I'm Tara Palmieri. From Something Else, this is Power, The Maxwells, Knee Deep in Muck.
Have you ever felt like escaping to your own desert island? Jane Gaskin did exactly that, trading in the family home to begin a new life in the tropics. But she soon discovers that paradise has its secrets. I'm Alice Levine, and this is The Price of Paradise, the island dream that ends in kidnap, corruption, and murder. Wish you were here? Follow The Price of Paradise now, wherever you listen to podcasts.
So this episode will be released in the spring, and Ghislaine's trial is set for the summer, July. What do you think is going to happen this summer?
We're still left with a lot of speculation in terms of what to expect. I mean, we do know sort of the same basic things that we knew when she was arrested and that we knew when Epstein was arrested. Like, the people who are heading this prosecution are not the people who typically would be heading human trafficking operations. They're in public corruption. And so I think we can expect to either see more arrests of high-ranking individuals who once held office or are still in office, or we can expect to hear testimony.
Right. Has anything surprising come out recently?
I mean, the DOJ report, the findings about, from the Office of Professional Responsibility were obviously a massive disappointment.
Yeah. The Department of Justice's Office of Professional Responsibility put out a report in early November evaluating how the Justice Department, the Southern District of Florida, handled the Jeffrey Epstein case and that unprecedented sweetheart deal. So basically, despite all of the exceptions that were made for Jeffrey Epstein, this unprecedented sweetheart deal, they said that it was Alex Acosta, who was the U.S. attorney at the time, was only guilty of bad judgment. Poor judgment? Or
poor judgment. Exercised poor
judgment.
Yeah,
was only guilty of exercising poor judgment. A slap on the wrist. And the report goes into the many details of that poor judgment, which many people walked away from saying that was way more than poor judgment.
It's just really a despicable, I guess, end as they see it to this case. I mean, poor judgment is like when you eat something that you found in the back of your refrigerator. It's not when you fail to hold like a child sexual predator to account repeatedly over and over again. It's just a complete dodging of any responsibility, and we should expect more from the Department of Justice, one of the, you know, the agencies that is supposed to hold criminals to account in our country. That's, for me, been the thing that really has stood out, is just a slap in the face to the survivors and, you know, everyone who was so much invested in this case.
There were a few things I saw in that report that really stuck out to me. One of them was that, I mean, we knew that Marie Villafañe, Acosta's assistant,
wrote this like massive prosecution memo, right? It was like 80 pages. But the fact that she recommended 60 counts for charges against Epstein and it ended up being nothing at all is like crazy. Like to actually see that number, like 60 criminal counts, like criminal charges. No, it's insane.
Absolutely. It really, and then to see Acosta refer to her as hard charging and someone else to say that she was out over her skis, like I have goosebumps now as I'm like thinking back to reading the report and seeing like the email exchange. It's just, for some reason, the phrase out over her skis just seems so incredibly sexist to me.
Oh my God. I know.
It's absolutely unbelievable.
It's absurd. And I hate that in their like overview of the report, they refer to the victims as girls, like call them what they are, minors.
There aren't words that this could be seen. It's a whitewash that it could be seen as an attempt to close out a series of massive failures with like one final cherry of a failure on top is just, it's unbelievable.
Gosh. Okay. So how much did you know about Robert Maxwell before producing the series and reporting on it?
Almost nothing. I'd never heard of Robert Maxwell. And it was only sort of slowly as I started becoming interested in Epstein and in Ghislaine that it was sort of like, oh, we have this other character in the UK that as an American, I've never heard anything about, but is, larger than life. And as Daniel Bates described him in season one of Broken, sort of a mix of Donald Trump and Rupert Murdoch. And I think you can't put it a better way. Sort of like a prequel, if you will, in a bit of a disconnected, but still incredibly intriguing way. I mean, You must have, what do you think about that?
I just see so many similarities between Robert Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, right? Both came from humble beginnings, right? I mean, when you put someone like that in British society, it's just like designed to make everyone feel so low, right? Like the whole aristocracy. So someone who has this huge chip on his shoulder is like destined to like self-implode, I think, in British society. And you add someone with a massive ego like Robert Maxwell, and it was like a fatal brew, right? I don't know that he would have imploded in the same way in the US, but who knows? Epstein, again, like also had this massive chip on his shoulder. Neither man went to college either, which is so fascinating to me. This obsession with wealth, you know, being so showy about your money, because there are people who are wealthy and then there are people who are really showy about their money. And both of them were exceptionally showy. You know, they just had a lot in common in the sense that they moved money around. And by like nature of doing that, they were very mysterious. Also, they had massive tempers. I mean, nobody really talks about that with Epstein. He was incredibly demanding of Ghislaine Maxwell. He often called her dumb and stupid in front of people. And Robert Maxwell treated his own daughter like that too sometimes. And then at the same time, like she just doted on these men. Her existence was to please both of them, to win their affections and then treat everyone else with disdain.
And then you have Ghislaine coming into Epstein's life when he was earlier in his money. And Ghislaine knew to have money in the way that her father had money, which is in the showy way. And, you know, we can't attribute everything to her, but also if she was basically the manager of Epstein's properties and also handling all his business, like the way that I sort of think about it as well is that she sort of built him in the image of her father, because that was, I mean, we know that Robert Maxwell was like, didn't like to have men around, didn't like to have her date. Like she, you know, she worked for him. She was very much involved with her family before he died. And so it's kind of like the one person she knew how to model Epstein after was her father.
In a lot of ways, it makes sense, but she felt like she needed to control him. And a lot of people think that she procured women because that was the way she felt that she could be useful to him.
If she felt like if he called her dumb and if she constantly was made to feel wanting, you could see how this would be the way that she could make herself useful and instrumental to his life. It's like it's a mechanism of control on her end because she can do something that he can't and that he needs.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Every day in America, 60 million packages are delivered. But we don't always know what's inside.
He bent down to pick the package up. That's when the device detonated.
Danger is everywhere, and no one is safe in Austin, Texas, as law enforcement hunts a serial bomber for 19 days. From Sony Music Entertainment, Campside Media, and Pegalo Pictures, this is Witnessed. 19 Days. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts to binge all episodes or listen weekly wherever you get your podcasts.
So, in episode 3, we hear about Robert Maxwell faking tears in court during a lawsuit with Private Eye magazine. He was trying to, you know, win the sympathy of the jury. He said, you know, my family was murdered in the Holocaust. I'm so insulted by the way that this magazine is, what this magazine is printing. It's a lie. But he really used that, you know, that family affliction to win the jury over. Have you ever seen that sort of manipulative behavior from Ghislaine?
We hear accounts from people over and over again that this was Ghislaine's deal, is she could be absolutely your best friend and also your worst enemy. I mean, some of the people that we spoke to for our show, she had the ability to leave you hating yourself, but also desperately wanting to be her friend and wanting her to like you.
So the powerful people that both Epstein and Maxwell were associated with, like, they certainly add interest in this story, right? I mean, there's princes, there's presidents, it's just the whole gambit, right? Politicians. Do you think this story would have been dramatically different if Ghislaine didn't have powerful friends that she introduced to Epstein and this mysterious past filled with scandal?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Like, tons of people traffic people for sex, and we don't hear about them, and they're not covered, and nobody cares because, you know, it's a random guy from Pennsylvania who brings women from Mexico. I mean, these cases are all over the Southern District. They're happening every day. But because there's no sparkle, people, like, you know, morally they care, like they think sex trafficking is bad, but there's no reason, they're so common that there's no reason to cover them.
Do you think Robert Maxwell, being who he was, has increased the level of conspiracies around Ghislaine's story?
Oh, 100%. 100%. Because you have a mysterious death that transports Ghislaine to the U.S. And so you have this shadowy person. When you start with that as the foundation of this story, it only gets crazier. I tend to think of myself as a fairly grounded person, but it's like the story is just so... There are so many ways that your mind can go. What has it been like for you working on a story where there are possibly more things to look into that feel conspiratorial than factual?
It's sort of like covering Trump in a lot of ways, you know, where he just like throws so much stuff at the wall and you know, like, none of it's really true, but like maybe there's one thing that's true. So you end up spending all your time trying to figure out what's factual and what's not. And while you're doing that, he's doing something else. Like, you know what I mean? Or you end up getting distracted down a rabbit hole when like the truth is somewhere else. It's really hard as a journalist. Like, it's really difficult. I feel that way about the Maxwell story. I feel that way about the Ghislaine Maxwell story, the Epstein story. But actually, like, a lot of the truth of it all, like, I know we always talk about, were Ghislaine and Epstein intelligence assets, either for Israel, for the United States? You know, was Robert Maxwell an asset more than maybe a guy who, like, went into, you know, MI6 and gave them tips that he heard on his international travels? Like, a true, like, asset that they used and put, like, in the field. It does, in a way, blur the whole story, which is more of a story of morality and, like, our system. Mm-hmm. Because instead of focusing on, like, the truly damning truth, you know, the way that in Epstein's case, the way that the Justice Department made exceptions for them because of their wealth, well, that's, like, bad enough, right? Like, I don't know. I just think that the conspiracies often take away from the obvious truths about our society and, like, what we value. And it just, you end up in, like, James Bond fantasy world instead of realizing, like, this is a dark story about our society.
absolutely. But it's also, you know, if you want to, you can look at it from top down, but you can also, if you want to go from bottom up, the problem is you start at the bottom and you start with conspiracy theories. And so much of being a reporter is talking to people and trying to figure out at a gut level if you trust them. And so to talk to someone who maybe, you know, 7 of the 50 things they tell you are true, but like the remaining things you can't confirm are, it's a really murky area to try to figure out what's actually, like, which way is up and which way is down. And it's—
Totally. And they use that. Like Robert Maxwell used that. He wanted people to think he was an intelligence asset. He wanted people to think he was more powerful than he was. Like, being shady was almost like an asset for him.
No, absolutely. And we have someone like Jeffrey Epstein you have a fake it till you make it attitude. I mean, you know, it's like before when he met Ghislaine, it's like he was pretending he lived in a penthouse apartment by throwing parties on a roof and like having the deli deliver. It's like, and if you have your spokesperson go and tell newspapers that you lost a bunch of money in a thing when you didn't actually lose a bunch of money, all it does is like amplify who you are. It's all about building a persona, even if it's not actually what exists.
It's hard to do these stories, and it's like how they got away with it for so long at the same time. Right. I mean, Jeffrey Epstein's death. The video is missing from the prison. What? Like, how do you think he died?
How do I think he died?
Yes.
It's so the whole thing is like, obviously the whole thing is messed up. The question is what is it messed up because it was intentionally messed up because he was killed, or is it messed up because we have a Bureau of Prisons where people are overworked and where things are very old and where money isn't allocated properly, where like we just accept now that there's like black mold in the MCC and that the water that comes out is moldy and that these people are living literally surrounded by bags of feces sometimes because the toilets go out or they're freezing because the heat goes out all winter and it's like they don't get it fixed. Sorry, I'll get to your question. But it's like
No, keep going.
But it's just, there's a point where it's like, yes, you can say, oh my God, he was killed. Like, Hillary Clinton killed him, like, if you want to go there. But at the same time, it's like, we have these facilities in society. They're not seen by the public. Like, they might be right next door to the courthouse, but they're just forgotten. And the people inside are forgotten, and they're not kept up to code because things are expensive. And, you know, bureaucracy sucks. I talked to a lot of people who used to work at the MCC and a former warden of the MCC. And it's like, if you actually look at the way that the MCC is built, like, we know he was in 10 South. There were not very many people in 10 South. There's a single key that you can use to get onto the walkway that would have led to his cell. That key was held by that correction officer and that other BOP employee who was not even a correction officer, who was there doing overtime because they were so short-staffed. What I think happened is I think that maybe he bribed someone so that he could kill himself. I don't think anyone else killed him. I think that he, as a person who was hedonistic, who we've heard needed to abuse 3 girls a day, needed 3 orgasms a day, he knew that he was looking at the rest of his life in prison. And so there are certain things that are a little odd about the cell, but I think what's more likely than anything else is that maybe he bribed someone to look the other way. Another death. How do you think Robert Maxwell died?
I think he offed himself. I think he jumped from the boat.
Why do you think
that? Because his life was imploding, just like Jeffrey Epstein, except he was in a prison. He's running this huge scheme where he's stealing pension funds. He's a coward. He just like left all that to his family. And I don't know, I know it's boring, but it's kind of like how you feel about Epstein. Yeah, but it showed that there was like a little bit of struggle. Like, he tried grabbing onto the boats, but maybe that was just like him like not fully committing to kill himself.
Yeah. No, I always think about that, like the torn muscles in his arm. Is it's like, yeah. Did he slip and did he try to catch himself, or did he jump and then did he have second thoughts?
Yeah. I'm sure like when it actually comes down to it, it's probably really frightening. Like, who really?
Oh, absolutely.
It's just not, you know, so, and that's not really an easy way to die either, by drowning.
No, it's a terrible—
I mean, this is getting really morbid right now, but, you know.
So do you have any idea what Ghislaine really believes about her father's death?
Okay, so that's a great question. Ghislaine expressed to a number of people that she believed her father was murdered. But one of the things that sort of just sticks in my mind is I spent a lot of time talking to Alan Dershowitz for Broken, even though we never ended up using any of his stuff. And he'd written a book review of some book that came out after Robert Maxwell's death that was saying that Robert Maxwell was killed by Mossad. And whatever his book review was basically saying, like, this is totally preposterous. Like, Robert Maxwell was not killed by Mossad.
Can I also put in a disclaimer that he also says that Trump won the election or Biden didn't win? But keep going.
So he wrote a book review. He writes lots of things, but it basically said, like, Robert Maxwell was not murdered. He said that Ghislaine Maxwell thanked him for that book review, and that in his conversations with Ghislaine, that she was under the impression that he was not murdered. He had a very vivid memory of her thanking him profusely for writing the review of
Got
the
it.
Book.
We should also note that Alan Dershowitz is a very respected legal scholar, right? I mean, he's not just some crazy conspiracy theorist, although his reputation has suffered.
Yeah. I don't know. Actually, back to Robert Maxwell's death, another thing that Alan Dershowitz told me was apparently on Robert Maxwell's body or on the yacht, some investigating agency found a planner of, like, people that Robert Maxwell wanted to meet with the next time he was in New York. And Alan Dershowitz's name was on that. And so maybe Maxwell was interested in sort of some white-collar representation, or was planning to, you know, preemptively do damage control as everything was falling apart. Yeah, that's just another thing that always sort of sticks in my mind, is that it seemed like he had plans. He wanted to talk to Alan Dershowitz. And the other name that Alan Dershowitz remembered being on that list was Mike Wallace.
The journalist.
Yeah.
See, but the thing is, the walls were closing in on him. So he needed journalists and lawyers. You know, things were cheery.
You don't need anyone else in life. Just surround yourself with journalists and lawyers.
Usually when things are bad, those are the people you're going to need. Or just off yourself. I don't know.
Those are the three options.
Exactly.
I mean, I guess the thing is so with Ghislaine, we have, like, she was associated with Epstein, and then she managed to kind of, like, get out of it. Like, by 2010, she was dating someone else, and she kind of rebuilt her life. And one of the things that really, I don't want to say surprises, I guess surprises, because, like, we can be so naive about these things, is she was still pretty active on the social circuit in New York and London, I mean, as late as 2016. Even though there'd been rumors out and about since the early 90s that she was getting schoolgirls for Jeffrey. And then we have, you know, Jeffrey, who's involved in this case, and then she somehow slips away. She's making
Virginia
donations.
Virginia sued her for defamation. That was pretty public, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And Virginia had come out with her story.
No, exactly. And so she's been sued in 2015, and still in 2016, we have photos of her at galas and hosting parties. I mean, what do you think that says, not about just New York society, but, like, society at large?
To quote the journalist Vicky Ward, in this city, money makes up for all sorts of blemishes. And mind you, this was possibly the first journalist who tried in earnest to report Epstein's abuse of Maria Farmer and her sister. And then the story never ran. It ended up being kind of more of a glowing, you know, James Bond mystery man, what they called a talented Mr. Epstein story on him in Vanity Fair. And then became friends with Maxwell and Epstein. Like, if that doesn't tell you everything, I don't know what else does.
So then, I mean, what's inconvenient for all of this is then we had Me Too.
I think the Me Too movement has actually given victims a voice for the first time, instead of just being like, you know, victim, dead girl, abused woman. You know what I'm saying? Like, we're starting to hear them as real people. And I think that's important. And I think, if anything, it's just, it makes it more shameful.
I think it's moved the barometer a little bit, too, because it's sort of like, I mean, it really is about reframing the way that you think about things. If you're taught to think about, like, high school girls as, like, jail bait, like, ooh, that's scandalous. Like, that's, you know, that's whatever. But then, like, if you actually are taught to think about it as, like, oh, like, this is child sex trafficking, this is abuse, like, this is unacceptable. Like, it just reframes mm-hmm. the way that you might look at that young girl who's at that party.
What do you think about what Christopher Mason said at the end of episode 7, that some of Ghislaine's friends are still protesting her innocence? Is there a sense that Ghislaine was a victim herself?
Well, I think that if you know someone and you know them in a certain context and they have not victimized you, it's really hard for many people to believe that someone is capable of such horrible things. But the thing about Ghislaine Maxwell is that, unlike, you know, high school girls who were brought in, were abused, and were manipulated into bringing other girls, like, Ghislaine Maxwell came into this as a nearly 30-year-old woman. And no one, even if they were friends with her, even if they had a great time with her, you know, some hard things happened to her in her life. Her dad died, et cetera. You know, that's happened to, like, horrible things happen to a lot of people, and they don't find themselves in the same situation.
Right. So far, she's only said she's a victim of the press.
Well, we're terrible.
We're the worst. Okay, before we wrap up, how has your perception of Ghislaine changed throughout your reporting?
At the very beginning, when Epstein was arrested, it was sort of like, oh, like, Epstein's, you know, poor girlfriend who was losing her man and, you know, was just trying to stay relevant because she was becoming an old hag, and this was what she had to do for love. She did it for love. But no, it's, you know, she was in a scenario where she was losing, you know, losing the life that she was accustomed to, and she made a series of calculated decisions, has been the main shift for me. Because just so often at the beginning, it was kind of like, oh, like, this poor, you know, girlfriend trying to stay relevant because he didn't love her. Like, no, that's, I mean, maybe that was part of her calculus, but that is not what we should be focusing on.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like I've seen more of the pain she suffered, I guess you could say, in her early life from her father and by being with Epstein, but I still don't have that, like, level of compassion for what she ended up doing or understanding. I don't understand her at all, to be honest.
Okay. She's an
I've seen people like her, but not to that degree. But it's frightening. I still think about that quote that Juan Alessi gave me in Broken when she said, "I hate him, but I can't leave him."
Mm.
And I'm like, was it psychological or was it financial?
Or was she being blackmailed?
Right. Okay.
And then the conspiracy theories start again.
It's, you know, it's the only way to end it. I also want to let you know that we're hard at work on the next season of Power. We have another amazing character who you think you know, but I promise you don't. I can't tell you who it is yet, but stay subscribed to this feed, and we'll announce all the details very soon. Power of the Maxwells is written and presented by me, Tara Palmieri. Producers are Paul Smith and Grant Irving. Story editor is Dasha Lisitsina. Our executive producer is Tom Koenig. Original music by Nolan Schneider. Engineering and scoring by Spoke Media and NPAL Audio. Our visual designers are Emma Lansdowne and Alex Elder. Special thanks to Ella McLeod, Joe Sykes, Russell Finch, Peggy Sutton, Steve Ackerman, and Mark Rivers.